Welcome to Elgin Movie Watchers Podcast. I'm Chuck Slatkin, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Steve Gould and Ian Slatkin, who's also our technical director and producer, or whatever we call him. So how you doing, Steve?
I'm doing great. I'm glad the three of us, the three amigos, are here to discuss another topic we hope is salient to our listeners.
Okay, we're doing it on sailboats. Okay, yeah. Before we get Ian in, I'll just quickly do the that you can follow us on Twitter at Elgin Movie, Instagram at Elgin Movie Watchers. You can get us on Facebook at Elgin Movie Watchers Podcast, and you can always contact us via email at elginmoviewatchers@gmail.com. So how you doing, Ian? Get in here.
I'm doing all right. Glad to be back.
So this is an interesting topic that we're dealing with.
Well, yes. I mean, you're right about that, Chuck. And I know pre-recording, we were kicking the gong around as a kind of a broad topic. When I was looking at films, even my wife, Nancy, said, boy, you know, you could really, in a sense, say, you know, people make movies, and obviously, you know, they make them hopefully to make money, but most of the time it's because somebody has a message. And it's true, but I thought if we just thought of this generally right now, if we hit on something, or even if some of our listeners have some thoughts about it, we could certainly specialize at a future podcast and just talk about like political message or social message or scientific message and things like that. But we just, I thought we could get an idea this way.
Well, for me to approach this, you know, I again, rather than assessing what other people thought films had message or were message films or whatever, I just, you know, looked at the films that I felt impacted me, also understanding that the film wasn't made specifically for me. So I would assume that there are other people who received, you know, their interpretation of what the message was. So there were a number of films that came to mind that I felt, and I guess maybe more by the nature of who I am, a lot of them are like, you know, political messages. One of the films that from the first time I saw it, I always thought it was an amazing film. I think I eventually got Steve to play it at the Elgin. It's a 1940 film, The Great McGinty.
Oh, wonderful film. Preston Sturges.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
And I mean, there have been a lot of films afterwards, I guess, that have tried to tackle, you know, political corruption and how, you know, the impact of it or whatever, but somehow this film really, you know, set it in such a way. And obviously, you know, Preston Sturges and the writers, they were making a point with this movie. There's nothing hidden message here.
Oh, no, that was Corruptionville. I always, if I got a friend that's going into politics, I said, before you do anything, I want you to watch The Great McGinty. And even baseball fans will like that, because there's a great scene with Brian Dunleavy trying to get a point across about graft and corruption. And he points to the stadium in Boston.
Here's the guy, McGinty himself, who was, a ne'er-do-well. He gets himself started in politics by offering to vote under different identities for $2 a piece, and he gets into it, and he ends up being governor. So I would.
No, it was mayor, I think. Mayor of Boston, right? Was it, or was he governor? I forget. All right.
He became mayor, and then he became governor.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. That's right.
I'm saying he ends up eventually.
Yeah.
He didn't just start, you know, doing illegal voting for $4 a vote. Yeah. He got, you know, bigger money. And then, of course, he got involved with a decent person, a woman, who originally they got together because for him to run to office, he needed to have a wife, they felt. So it was just a marriage of convenience for the campaign. And eventually, I guess they fall in love and get in a relationship, and she's more, you know, an honest person and has impact on him. I won't give the whole movie away, but yeah. You know, for a 1940 movie, it still holds up, you know, in 2022 because
it's
stuff that we have to deal with. You know, it hasn't been resolved. So before I go on to the rest of my list, let's hear from you guys about the films.
Well, you know what I was thinking when you were talking about The Great McGinty. We missed our chance at the Elgin as a double bill because everybody knew Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which is such a wonderful kind of like a upbeat whitewash of a good guy going down there and trying to do something. And what could happen with The Great McGinty? You know, it would have been a great double bill. But one movie that I thought almost could be the poster child for a message movie is It's a Wonderful Life. You know, I mean, I have to say, being a foolish romantic at heart, around the holidays when I do see that, I still can get a little teary-eyed at Capra, but I guess that's pretty good considering Nancy and I don't have kids. But I mean, it's just the whole wonderful story about if you weren't born, what would have happened? You know, I mean, so that was the one that I would use as a poster child for message movies. How about you, Ian? What do you got in your hopper?
Well, I'm going to bring it to my childhood, which is not necessarily your childhood.
Okay.
You were fully formed adults by the time this movie came out, but I saw it at 9 years old, which is probably very intense for a 9 year old to see this film. Do the Right Thing. I know we talked about it before on the podcast, but I remember as a 9 year old being, you know, shaken by that film when I saw it, not just because of what happened in it, but just the messages. And, you know, there's things that I hadn't even experienced yet that were shown to me in that film and, you know, later on experienced.
Yeah.
Put Spike Lee on the map, right?
Yeah, and he had, what's her name, Ruby Dee and her husband in that film.
Yeah, Ozzie
and then,
Davis.
Ozzie Davis, and then Danny Aiello was the pizza man, wasn't he?
Right,
yeah. John Turturro was his son.
Yeah.
It was great. You know,
powerful. Yeah. And you know what is good, and and you bringing that up. Yeah, you were 9 years old, but I think it's good if, I mean, not to, like, shocked the shit out of a child, but I think it was good that your parents thought enough of you and your growing intellect that you should see it, you know, because number one, it was a good film, but it had a message too. So I think that's great. And, you know, parents should keep that in mind, not to, you know, pull their child by, oh no, they shouldn't see that yet, you know? So I think that's good.
I mean, well, when you grow up in New York City, you grow up a little bit faster. So especially when you have a brother who's 5 years older than you, so you kind of it's the way it goes. You know, the things I was seeing at six, they weren't maybe as scary, but they, you know, arousing is probably the other way of saying gratuitous nudity of the 80s comedies that I sat through as a young child.
Yes. I don't know what kind of parents you had, and they should definitely
What else? I mean, I'll throw one out in the hopper, which people will say, well, this isn't really a message movie, but I really think it was of almost biblical proportion, almost, you know, a parable of Cain and Abel. And that's not one of my favorite political persons, but a great director, Ilya Kazan, and he did a movie called East of Eden, that James Dean played an errant son that was really looking for love of his father, and the father kept giving all of the love to the other son, it struck me as an incredibly powerful movie dealing with what really happens. Somebody doesn't understand what love is, you know. It's it was really, and well, Chuck and I played the hell out of it because it's a well done movie and people liked it.
I don't think we never showed it with media with the great McGinty though.
No, never did. No. So what else you got in your basket there, Chuck?
Well, this is, skates that line again about messages. But one film that I really found impacted me when I saw it, mm-hmm. and because of what it was covering and its unique style and its mixture of, like, you know, fiction and nonfiction into a film, was Medium Cool.
Okay.
Haskell Wexler's film that was made around the time of the 1968 Chicago convention.
Yeah.
So there's a whole story going on within the film that in itself is interesting, but also the fact that these fictional characters are out there in while all this amazing, you know, nonfiction stuff is taking place. So I mean, obviously it probably affected the maybe other filmmakers, and eventually it got some good reviews, but eventually it was considered, you know, an important film and got, you know, whatever it is, get the Library of Congress and all that kind of stuff. So I would think that, you know, Medium Cool impacted me because of the message, but also the combining of, you know, a fictional story, which had, you know, elements that were important to it, but it was filmed right in the middle of an amazing, you know, a time and, you know, nonfiction event. I thought it was a tremendous film. So,
yeah.
I don't know if it's really...
Wexler, years before, was he was really sought after as one of the finest cinematographers in Hollywood. And he really wanted to make this movie. And I think he did a hell of a job, because to this day, it's a cult film about the 60s.
There you go. And I'll throw in another one, because I have to throw this in every episode, no matter what the topic
what,
is.
What, A Thousand Clowns?
No, Citizen Kane.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Which in itself was a message movie. Yep. And, you know, the...
Rosebud.
Yeah, quasi biographical film and getting into the whole thing. But I kind of looked into it a little bit. And the fact that Wells was basically given the opportunity to do this film from his radio productions.
Right.
And he was given basically total freedom to do this. He had never directed anything before. And that he had final cut privilege and all this amazing stuff. And while it got great reviews, it didn't do business. And it wasn't until years later, when people started writing about the great films, that Citizen Kane, you know, began to get to be seen by people. I had no knowledge of that. So I it's part of my role here to bring Citizen Kane into every topic, and to make sure if there are people out there who haven't seen it, you know, please check it out. To me, it's an amazing film, you know, that still holds up to today. So I'll step aside for you before I mention any of my others.
All right. I think Ian might have something under his hat there.
I got one. I don't know if you guys ever got a chance to show this at the Elgin. Its messages of, you know, about mass media and corporate control of it is a Network. That really, I saw that when I was in my college years and studying media itself, and that really kind of like blew me away, that movie. I've been, even, you know, 20 years or whatever it was, 20 some odd years later, it was still like so effective on me. It's a great film in general.
Actually, one of the minor channels that they have now, last night, Network was on it, and we watched a section of it. You know, I just love Peter Finch when he's, open your windows, help, you know. How come it didn't make a greater impression on people to watch out for the shit that's happening in social media now. But there's a couple of movies that I know you guys probably haven't heard of, and this is one of them is thanks to one of these digital channels. I totally came out of the blue one time when we were watching it. A young Spencer Tracy. And it was one of Fritz Lang's first movie when he came over here from Germany right after M. And it was called Fury. And basically it was a story about a young man, Spencer Tracy, who was accused of a crime and was awaiting in prison, you know, the whole thing. But it was a story about how people jumped to the conclusion, and the sheriff tried to stop him. And anyhow, the whole place burned down, but thank God he wasn't killed. And Sylvia Sidney, who was on Movie Watch, she played his interest and a love interest. And it was a really powerful movie about what happens when, you know, a crowd gets so, well, January 6th, yeah. Example. So that's something. But on a more optimistic note, this is something that my wife Nancy turned me on to. It's by the director is Ron DeRoss, and I don't know, I mean, it must have been a contract director out in Hollywood, but it was made right after World War II, 1947, and it's called It Happened on Fifth Avenue. And it's such a wonderful, small little movie. The guy who plays the lead is Victor Moore, who, you know, is, you know, kind of a B actor, but he does such a wonderful job. The premise was that he was homeless, and he knew on Fifth Avenue when the rich people leave for Florida, and he knew how to gain entry to one of these mansions. And he gets in, and he doesn't, you know, abuse it at all, but he lives there because it's warm and, you know, these kind of thing, and goes out and gets a little food, brings it in. But then all of a sudden people see him and they come in, and Charlie Ruggles, who actually owns the house, makes believe he's homeless and comes in too. And it's probably one of the most upbeat movies I have seen in years. It's called It Happened on Fifth Avenue, and it's from 19. So, I mean, those are two kind of small, insignificant movies. But if anybody listening here wants to see something that's a little different, one being very powerful and violent, and the other very upbeat.
Okay. I've never seen it, but I will. I'll bring up another film that I thought about just recently. Just from seeing the way, you know, the news is going and the discussion of some of these younger heads of state, or whatever, I say younger than us anyway, they're actually discussing, you know, the viability of using nuclear weapons at this point, yeah. When you would think that there would have been some consensus that it couldn't even be considered by anybody. It's pretty frightening. So it brought me to think about Dr. Strangelove as a message film.
On my list, yeah.
In addition to a great comedy and black comedy, Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. Stanley Kubrick produced it, directed it, and what wrote the screenplay, 1964.
64, yeah.
Yeah. Who wrote the screenplay, Stanley Kubrick, Terry Southern, and Peter George. And of course, the other aspect of it, which is a phenomenal thing, is the roles that Peter Sellers played in it, which in itself is, he played the an RAF officer, he plays the President of the United States, and then the nuclear war expert in the wheelchair, and a former Nazi with his hands syndrome. If people haven't seen it, trust me, it's well worth the seeing it, because it really will holds up, and it's an extraordinary thing with an extraordinary cast. I mean, beyond Peter Sellers playing all these roles, George C. Scott, Sterling Hayden, Keenan Wynn, and of course, James Earl Jones is in it. And of course, we can't leave out Slim Pickens.
Oh, that's my favorite scene.
That's one of the great rides of all time.
Yeah.
So I would say go ahead.
No, Slim. But I was going to also add that scene with Slim Pickens, you know, riding it. Kubrick, you know, had the smarts to add that wonderful Vera Ellen rendition of "We Will Meet Again." I don't know where, I don't know when. I mean, it's just that's one of my favorite Kubrick movies. It really is.
Yes. Yeah. So
that's got a message.
Oh yeah, and unfortunately,
but they ain't listening.
You know, it's become relevant again for people to see because of the times we're in. Yeah. So okay, well, I'll throw out one more.
Okay.
Even though I have quite a few more, but this is a message story. Mm-hmm. And Born on the 4th of July.
Yeah.
Which I had read the book, which came out years, and there were problems getting this film made. I mean, it wasn't actually made probably until 1989, and the book was like 1976 or earlier that Ron Kovic wrote the book, and then they got it, and then it got all tied up with. So eventually, you know, Roger Stone, who had been hired to do the screenplay, eventually got the ability to direct it, and then Tom Cruise played the lead. Yeah. But to me, I'm an anti-war person. I was certainly an anti-war person when I read the book. I was an anti-war person, obviously, when I saw the movie. But the film is very powerful because they really go into, you know, from him being a kid on Long Island and the messages he was getting and how he responded to, you know, JFK's speech and joining the Marines and what he goes through and his experiences, not really holding back anything whatsoever. And to the point where, you know, he gets, ends up becoming, you know, an anti-war person and, you know, severely injured and,
yeah.
But to me, you know, if I was going to say, well, what's an anti-war film that you could point to, but one that, in a sense, it's this guy's story. You know, it's an, you know, autobiographical, you know, book. And I think Oliver Stone does a phenomenal job, you know, directing it. So to me, even after all these years of my, I haven't read the books, I would say that, you know, for a message movie, you know, Born on the 4th of July definitely delivers the message about, you know, the horror of war and the reasons not to have war, but also shows the evolution from this, you know, kid growing up on a family in Long Island and gung-ho to, you know, enlist, move to serve his country, and then getting to the point of understanding, you know, the horrors that were committed, the horrors he was involved with committing, and trying to come to terms with that, and being beaten by the police at the Republican National Convention and arrested, you know, in a wheelchair, and then, you know, whatever it means now, big picture, and then actually, you know, getting to speak at the Democratic National Convention. It's quite a story, and the message is received clearly, and I would recommend it strongly. So that's...
It's strange that, I don't know if we could ever, it had to be a, there are so many almost anti-war movies. Why is there still war? You know, it's, when you were talking about Born on the 4th of July, I thought of one. That was a 1930 film that was based on a book about a guy who was in World War One, Erich Maria Remarque, All Quiet on the Western Front. Definitely. And it was about a young kid who bought the, you know, drank the Kool-Aid and joins, you know, the German war machine. And he gets over there and he is absolutely so disillusioned about it, you know. And that was a movie that was, what, 75 years before, yeah, Ron Kovic's thing. And then right, one that happened in the 50s that I thought was an incredibly powerful film and that couldn't be shown in France for years was Paths of Glory, about this, and Kirk Douglas plays I think it was in 57, plays a colonel that is fighting for the lives of four of his men that this pompous ass general said disobeyed orders and they were cowards, and he had them executed. I mean, you know, this is like just gets me nuts. It really does. So I just thought I'd throw those in because it's a link of all of these anti-war films, and I guess there's many protest songs that say, "When will they learn? When will they ever learn?" Well, there's a bunch of others that we could throw into the hopper. You didn't even mention one I thought you'd mention. Speaking of messages, was and it's a recent one, Aaron Sorkin's film, Trial of the Chicago Seven. I mean, well, that's got a lot of message in it. Might have come from 1968, but it's current today.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. I've got a number of films. Actually, you mentioned 1967 and the Trial of the Chicago Seven, and it made me think of Abbie Hoffman, sure, who actually... has a cameo in Born on the 4th of July. They have a student protest in Syracuse, and there appears Abbie as a student strike organizer at Syracuse University. Unfortunately, he shot the film, and then he died before it came out.
Yeah.
But also Edie Brickell appears as a folk singer at that same Syracuse University anti-war protest. So anyway, I don't know what that means, but Born on the 4th of July and the Trial of the Chicago Seven, there's a double bill for you.
One movie that we should actually try to strap all of those crazy bastards that are in the Ukraine region lobbing rockets at the nuclear reactor, we should strap them in their chairs and make them watch the China Syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, that's definitely got a message, but it was made in 79. James Bridges, I think, was the director. And that had Fonda and Jack Lemmon. And it just, you know, China Syndrome basically is about... what happens when the shit hits the fan with a nuclear reactor. And it was actually being shown first run around the country at the same time, because it was 1979, that 3 Mile Island was going through some bad stuff, which was nuclear reactors in Pennsylvania. So I don't know, you know. We're getting a lot of messages out there, but we got to get the people's ears cleaned or something. They're not listening.
Well, that definitely impacted me and Ian's mother, because she was pregnant with Ian when those two things happened, the film and then 3 Mile Island.
Yeah.
And she went to Florida to get away. We had no idea what the extent of 3 Mile Island was going to be, because we didn't know. So that was a few years ago, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't even know if Ian was even aware of that. Were you?
I did not.
Well,
he knows now. So maybe, well, I don't know. Should we think of
part doing two,
another part two? Because we know there's a lot. Maybe we can, as Ian suggested pre-podcast, maybe we could specify a little so that we could talk about a particular message. But I think this gives our listeners a food for thought, and maybe some movies that they hadn't seen, an opportunity to have something
definitely
in their lives. Yeah, they could add. So,
well, I can just mention a few more films on my list that we can definitely deal with in part two, maybe part three.
Sure, sure.
Philadelphia.
Amen.
93.
Yep.
All also, the President's Men.
Okay.
Dallas Buyers Club.
Oh, okay. I wouldn't have thought of that. Good. Okay.
And here's one you probably would have thought of, Clockwork Orange.
Oh, yeah.
The Matrix. And, well, we will mention these. And if I could, Manchurian Candidate, the original one.
Yeah, the original. Don't think about the new one. Yeah. But, you know, in terms of prejudice, and we saw this again on, as Ian pointed out, one of these digital stations, and it still holds up. I mean, okay, yeah, it's in black and white. And they're in weird clothes because it's, you know, from the, you know, the 50s. But Gentleman's Agreement, which deals with religious prejudice.
Yeah, I think we should, we definitely have enough material to definitely consider to continue doing this, these message films in future episodes. If there's anything that Ian would like to mention, we should just maybe sign off for this episode and get to work on the next one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds good.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank everybody for viewing this episode, and we'll look forward to getting out the next one on Elgin Movie Watchers Podcast.
You know what the you know what the message is for the Elgin Movie Watchers Podcast?
What's that?
You got to have the listeners tell us what's their message film.
There you go.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Thank you, guys. Thank you.